Views and opinions expressed by callers, guests, and hosts do not necessarily reflect those of the Black Talk Radio Network and Black Talk Media Project. Black Talk Radio is new black media for the new millennium.
I'm Jay Mawid, co-host of Race Treaty, a radio show that is more than a radio show. It's a place where good people, organizers, come together and address the issues, the problems, the plans in front of our lives to live a full life. And we have come to see the instrument of CERD, the Convention to Eliminate Racial Discrimination, as a key element in this quest for life. It is the affirmation of human rights that we all have because God gave them to us. But as my teacher, Yusef Clay, has taught us, jus auditor, that there is no right that you have that will be actually adhere to or recognize unless you, in fact, bring it into existence through your efforts. So we know having the right or have it articulated is one thing. Standing on your right and living out of that conviction is another. So the program was started by Robin Benton, the co-host, and he will be joining us shortly. And we have put together a host of very dedicated, compassionate people who are truly competent and have been consistent, not in a year, not in 5 years, not in 10 years, not in 20 years. We are talking about people who have been advancing the black human rights struggle over sometimes 30, 40 years. And to have such an assortment of and caliber of a panel such as this is truly a great experience. It's been said that many are called, a few are chosen. And also it says that when there's a problem, the people come to support one another and see indeed it is a problem. I mean, of course, it's been a problem, but sometimes it has different faces, and the faces can become more grotesque as one we're facing now in terms of ideology, intention, and planning, and administration. So, let me do a check-in to find out who actually is here so I know how to move forward. Is Vicky on the phone yet?
Brother Anaje, this is Scotty, your engineer. I do think we have Robin or someone who's tagged their name as Robin on the line. To unmute yourself, if you're invited to participate in this broadcast, hit ** to unmute yourself, but at all times, please try to minimize any background noise. But yes, hit **, that will unmute you. I see you on the board. If we can get Rob.
You haven't heard anything I said so far?
I'm sorry?
Have you heard anything I said so far?
Yes, we heard everything.
Okay, wasn't sure. Okay, got it. So I should do, I do star on my phone at this point?
Yeah, you were unmuted, Brother Najee, but just to let the other people know that's on the call, if they're invited to speak, how to work the board is star to mute and unmute yourself. So please continue, sir.
Okay, thank you so much. So all of the invited guests, I'm asking you to star on your phone, do star, and that would unmute your phone. And once you do that...
Hello, yes, this is Professor Vanilla Randall. Good afternoon.
Oh, my goodness. Queen Mother. Oh, my goodness. Queen Mother is here. This is wonderful. Thank you so much. Presente. Wonderful. Welcome.
Thank you so much for inviting me, and I hope to be here for the full time, but I may have to leave early, but I want to be here as long as I can.
Okay, thank you so much. And who else is on the phone? Unmute yourself and introduce who's here.
Hi, Vicki Casanova Willis from the National Conference of Black Lawyers.
Oh my goodness, this is wonderful. Yes, anyone else?
Yes, this is Brother Tom DeBonju from Denver, Colorado.
Oh, okay,
brother, pleasure to be here.
Oh my goodness, I'm just delighted. Anyone else? So, Robin is here,
like
my co-host.
And overwhelmed by the presence of the group that are spending their time to discuss this issue and join this energy. I'm so appreciative of everybody here tonight. Thank you, Anaji, for spearheading this.
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you. So, for those of you who might not have seen the promo for this evening's program, it said something like the black human rights struggle has been happening ever since we landed on these shores and has had a number of high points, successes and failures. And we wanted to look at the black human rights struggle particularly in this year of 2016 as we get ready for 2017. And that discussion is going to happen by examining what role you and your organization, well, first of all, saying a little bit about yourself, right? Second, saying something about your organization, and then we'll go around like that first. And then the second set of questions will be, how was your organization participating in the movement for human rights cities, if in fact you are, and if not, then of course you can say that. And then the last question will be, how was your organization positioned and participating in the United Nations World a decade of African people from 2015 to 2024? So the first round will be introductory, your name, your organization, contact information in terms of how people can contact your organization through your either email or website or phone if you choose. And then we'll have maybe some crosstalk, and then we'll come back around a second time in the substance of the program. And I would like to start in the way in which people introduce themselves, and I certainly want to defer to Queen Mother because she said she's not sure how long she can stay on the phone. So, Queen Mother, at any point in time in the program, it's time for you to go. You see, anticipate that you would have to go, interrupt us, and say, "This is the time that I need to take," and then I can give you that 5 or 10 or 15 minutes, whatever time you need at that point, to make sure that your presentation is provided so the listening audience can hear that. It can be recorded, and we can use that as an education for future people who will find out about the program and will listen in. So I would like to start with Queen Mother to give us the introduce herself and her organization.
Well, thank you so much. I truly, truly appreciate the two of you all putting this together. It is work, the work that you all are doing on this is really important. As you know, that we don't have a human rights record in this, a positive human rights record in the United States. And we are far from being able to brag about anything. My name is Vernelia Randall, Professor Vernelia Randall. I'm a professor emerita of the University of Dayton School of Law. I am co-founder of Racial Justice Now, which is a local organization. I am retired, as I said, from the University of Dayton, and with the Racial Justice Now, my activities are pretty much limited to working on the school to prison pipeline. I have been involved in the rights struggle for 40, 50 years, and was actively involved in the World Conference Against Racism to the point that I got my university declared an NGO for participation in the World Conference Against Racism. I think that I'll stop right there. The primary focus of my work are two areas: looking at the health disparities issues of African Americans. I've been doing that for over 50 years, and looking at the school to prison pipeline with focus on suspension of young children, and I've been doing that since retirement. And I'll let someone else talk.
Santisana. You said 50 years? I've been
actively working either in healthcare or in law on issues related to human rights and in human rights area since 1968.
Oh, thank you so much, Elder. She and I met, in fact, in Durban, South Africa, both from United Snakes of America. We went all the way to South Africa to meet each other, and it is so wonderful to be connected with you again. And of course, the last time we saw each other, when you came from Ohio to Baltimore to participate in a UN event where the United Nations experts on working community on African people came to Baltimore for other cities, and you gave testimony. So it is wonderful to be in your media electronic presence. Thank you so much. So now we're going to move to us.
I would like to say one more thing. Just I have a website that's been on the internet for over 20 years. It's called racism.org. So that's if anybody wants to know more about the work that I do and information about racism and the law. You can go to racism.org.
Fabulous. Thank you. Moving in the energy of my art, Sister Vicky.
Hi. Yes, thank you so much to everyone for taking this time out. You know, we are currently commemorating and celebrating Kwanzaa, and it's just so appropriate that with the principle of Nia today, focusing on us on purpose, right, that we are privileged to have this very intentional discussion about the human rights movement and the need specifically for African descendants to ensure that we are continuing to press forward, to reach out, to communicate, and to be just very purposeful about advancing this work. My name is Vicky Casanova Willis. I serve as the president and board chair for the National Conference of Black Lawyers. I also have been a member of the U.S. Human Rights Network for a number of years, and it's a real privilege to be a part of this conversation today with several folks who were in leadership in that work and in the circle that was continuing to educate and bring additional people in when I first really became aware of some of the work that was beginning here in the U.S. from a standpoint of advancing our knowledge and our real application of human rights standards beyond civil rights. So obviously as a member of NCPL, well, maybe not obviously to everyone, I am a non-lawyer. NCPL is lawyers, activists, and community members. It was founded in 1968 in the height of the civil rights movement, and very much intentional there of being lawyers, but also very grassroots and community focused. So we have obviously in 50 years done a great deal of evolving, and as the struggles that face our people continue to escalate, so must the tools that we utilize and the human rights efforts that we've been able to apply here, especially in Chicago with the leadership initially of my husband, Attorney Stan Willis, to literally learn about and begin to apply the international human rights framework here at home is really something that has gotten some traction, and we're learning that more and more it is really where we need to focus. So NCBL, our website is www.ncbl.org, and again, that's the National Conference of Black Lawyers, but we work very closely as a member of the U.S. Human Rights Network as well.
Sati Sana, thank you so much for reminding us that it is Kwanzaa, and isn't it something that we are actually convening on the day of near purpose? Thank you. We're going to talk about that again as well. I think Brother Dr. Bantu, were you the next person?
Yes.
Called?
Yes, sir.
Very good.
Thank you.
Yes.
First of all, let me thank you and Brother Rob and all those who are making it possible for us to reach out to one another technologically, perhaps I should say. It's really good to be with you all this evening. It's particularly good to have a chance to sort of connect in this fashion with you, Brother Onaji, and Sister Vicky. You know, I haven't seen you all since the Human Rights Cities meeting some time ago, but the work is still in our hearts, and we continue to press forward. And it's also very good to reconnect with Queen Mother Randall, because it was on the way to Geneva that I actually met the Queen Mother a number of years ago. We were there together for the 2008 review of the U.S. Record of compliance and non-compliance with the CERD or ICERD document, the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination. So it's good to be here. My name is Tonda Bantu Iverson. I currently live in Denver, Colorado. I came back to Denver. I'm originally from Ohio, right up the road from Sister Randall. I was born in Zanesville and was reared in Columbus, Ohio, where my mother and father were very much a part of the struggle, which resulted in my father becoming the first African-American bus driver in Columbus, Ohio. So in a sense, I cut my teeth, so to speak, on struggle for jobs, struggle for economic, social, and cultural rights, struggle for racial dignity and self-determination a long, long time ago. I have been fortunate. I have been blessed to be one of the founding members of the U.S. Human Rights Network, and that's one of the places where I've met both Sister Vicki, and her illustrious husband, Brother Stan Willis. Actually, it was in Geneva where I actually made Stan's acquaintance and got to know him a little bit better as he gave testimony in that forum. And so today I am an independent labor educator and human rights activist here in Denver, and we are continuing to try to work with folks in Black Lives Matter. We're trying to work with younger brothers and sisters around the struggle for housing here in Denver. Some of you may already know Denver has some skyrocketing rents, and it is very, very difficult to find decent housing in the Denver, Colorado. Whatever the word out in the ether are about Denver being a go-to city, it's important for people to understand that most people in Denver, Colorado are rent poor, which is to say that they have to spend at least one-third of their income just to find a decent place. So we're continuing to work on those struggles, and I'm very glad to be here with all of you.
Shanti Simon, thank you, beloved. Thank you so very much. And then I think the co-host was the next person that signed on, Brother Robin. Okay, I'm not sure if he's on. He's in Michigan, so I don't know if he might be having some technological problems.
No, he's on. Like to... Brother Robin, your phone might be muted, but your mic is unmuted here on the board. He may not be able to speak, Brother Onaje.
Okay, got it. All right, so... Lamp Fall is a brother who hasn't been doing direct human rights work like we have on the panel, but he's been doing human work. He represents an organization that he can tell us about, because we want to see this connection, and he has some very strong roots and connections with our people in Africa, in Senegal in particular. So, Brother Lamphile, please introduce yourself and your organization.
We're not hearing anything. Again, if you just joined us, to unmute yourself, hit
Lamphile,
star.
You would have to push your phone star twice to unmute yourself, because if you're talking, we can't hear you.
Star twice?
Yes. Now I can hear you.
Okay.
So, yes.
My name
yes,
is
brother, please.
Shahid L. I go by the name within the Mourid community of Senegal, West Africa, as Shiloh Lamphile. I am new to the panel, and I was listening to what the brothers were saying, and the good brother that invited me here wanted me to introduce myself, but I am from Gary, Indiana, the little city about 20 minutes from Chicago. I reside in Pennsylvania, city of Philadelphia. Beautiful family. I am head of an organization called Medina Tu Salam. It's a Dara of thanks from one of the West African spiritual masters that goes by the name of Sering Salihu. So my story really begins with me coming through the, what I would call the Islamic tradition of North America with Noble Drew Ali. That tradition started about 1913. Drew Ali passed about 1929, and the Nation of Islam began a little bit after that. So I started out in the Moor Science Temple, rose through the ranks, and met a brother from Senegal in about 2000. Met a brother in about 97 that introduced me to the teachings of Sheikh Amadou Bamba. And from that, I've been on the search of knowledge itself and really trying to find out the relationship between man and God and how people can get along and find what we call peace with in this world of me and mine and you and yours and give and take. So I'm a simple brother. Just studying Islam from an African perspective, and I want to make my contribution to whatever I can right now in the present, whether it's an adult, child, or even yet the unborn. I just want to make sure that I leave my mark and represent my sheikh, my teacher, my spiritual master, and the best of men. Thank you.
Thank you so much, brother. Thank you so much. And we would want you to talk more about this connection between you and African brothers in Senegal, and tell us about the community and how the progress they've made in terms of working, you know, with NIA, and also working with Ujima, Collective Work Responsibility. So the first round was us introducing ourselves and the panelists anyway, and their respective organizations. So I'm going to try again to have the founder of Race Treaty and co-host, Robin Benton, to say a little words about why, you know, who he is and how he started this and what is his intention for this radio program. Robin, are you able to speak to us at this point?
Brother Najee, he's no longer on the line. I don't know what kind of issues he might be having, but let's just hope that he's okay. I'm sure he'll rejoin us if he's able. I can speak to your question, being that Race Treaty is hosted on Black Talk Radio Network, which is a platform that's managed by the North Carolina-based nonprofit Black Talk Media Project, which started off with the mission, which was inspired by Malcolm X commenting on the power of the media and how it controls the minds of the masses and how they can make the innocent look guilty and the guilty look innocent. And so since 2008, we've been working to elevate independent Black voices. And when I started looking, our organization started looking to subsidize some programming on our network, I knew that Robin, who I have a connection to, he's a fellow North Carolinian. He is from here as well. And so I was connected to him through social media, and I knew him to be very knowledgeable on human rights. And I wanted to work with him to bring a program to our network listeners focusing more on human rights as opposed to civil rights. So that's how Race Treaty was born. Thank you.
So I'm so glad that you mentioned, you came in, Scott, to share with us who you are and the station, how it got started. Brother Fatimantu said, you know, thank you for connecting us electronically. Well, that thing goes to you, brother, because you are the one who had the idea and put in the long hours, who knows how many thousands of hours, to bring it into existence and to keep it into existence. So we want to give you kudos for your vision and for your hard work. You know, thank you so much. So with that, I want to now move into Human Rights City, to have in the same order to say what is your involvement with the Human Rights Cities? What is it, first of all? What is your involvement with it? And what do you intend to get from it in terms of it being a conduit for the fulfillment of your goals, your organization goals, and certainly the ultimate goal, the liberation of our people? And we'll go around and then maybe have some cross talk about that, and then we'll go with the last question. And then if we are able to have questions and answers from the listening audience, we'll entertain that as well. So, Queen Mother, we're going to start with you. Your knowledge of your involvement with the Human Rights Cities movement.
Okay, to understand the Human Rights Cities movement, I think one of the things you have to do is put in context the human rights situation in the United States. People, as far as I can understand, and I'm open to be corrected, is that there are no explicit human rights in the United States. You do not have a right, substantive rights. We have a lot of procedural rights, but we have no substantive right, no right to education, no right to housing, food, clothing, no real right to work, to tell you that. Most of the rights that we have are substantive rights, and a procedural right. And a large part of that is both how the founders formed the Constitution, but also because the United States consistently signs human rights treaties in a way that provides Americans no more rights than what they have under the Constitution. That is a consistent limitation that they put in all the treaties on human rights they sign. Well, what they basically say then, for people who don't, you know, if you don't have an understanding of the United States Constitution, then you don't realize that what they're basically saying is these treaties, these human rights treaties, provide no more protection than what the Constitution provides. And as we know, the Constitution provides no human rights protections, or very little human rights protection. So part of the, and then the second point to make about the United States and how it deals with human rights treaties is that it doesn't make, it signs these treaties, it ratifies them, but unlike trade treaties, they don't automatically become the law of the land. So the result is that the human rights treaties are interesting sort of moral things that are out there, but they don't have the strength of law until some level of government adopts them. As far as I know, the Congress, for instance, have never adopted the Convention on Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination as law for the United States. So while they ratified the treaty and did that, they didn't pass it into law, so it doesn't have the force of law. So the question becomes then, how do we get these the human rights, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the other standards, how do we get them into our laws, policy statements, and programs? And the Human Rights Cities looks at the idea that getting it at the municipal level, that people have more political power and political control at the municipal level than any other level of government, and that what we should be doing is getting local governments to explicitly adopt the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and or other human rights treaty. For me, that's third. I am very interested in seeing cities actually adopt the Convention on Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination. I have not been actively involved in the human rights cities movement. I have started discussion with Dayton Human Rights Relations Council to try to see if we can get some of the human rights declarations adopted into the municipal law here in Dayton. I think, and because I haven't been directly involved in the human rights city movement on a national level, I think someone else would be better able to give a national overview of what's going on in the national advocacy level. So I'll stop there.
That's a perfect segue. Thank you so much for giving us that overview, that contextual, historical overview of the sleight of hand that this country has become a master in doing, saying something one side of their mouth and doing something exactly opposite. And certainly we're reminded of Bill Clinton creating the national race dialogue with John Hope Franklin on one side and sending a representative Richardson to Geneva to say that we don't need another global United Nations conference on racism. See, saying
and in
to the public.
And in fact, that's a good example because during the 2001 World Conference, in preparation for the World Conference before Bush got in, one of the preparatory meetings when the Clinton administration didn't think there was any Americans around, a delegate from the government said in front of an international audience that there were many things that they would do regarding race, but one of the things that they would never do is apologize for slavery.
Defiance and arrogance. So we see again how this country has positioned itself in the world, a body of being a human rights advocate, but at the same time, very skillfully denying it. And of course, we can go back to the 13th Amendment to say that slavery and involuntary servitude are abolished, and then what do? Turn right around and say it can be used except in the case of a punishment of crime. So this sleight of hand is their very basic way of thinking and operating, of giving the appearance of doing something that's correct and above board, but all the while having these devious intentions of denying the things they're saying that is that they're putting forth. So thank you so much for bringing that to our attention. And I said it's a perfect segue because we have one of the co-founders of the National Steering Committee who can tell us more about the Human Rights City movement and her involvement and why she wants and why she has involved the National Conference of Black Lawyers in that movement. Sister Vicky.
Hi, yes, thank you. So I think we might even have to step back in a second and just talk a little bit about, you know, concretely about what the difference is, right, between human rights and, say, civil rights or whatever other rights. And, you know, the simplest level is just that, as Professor Vernelia just mentioned, Professor Randall, that from a civil standpoint and from the Constitution, we have some man-made laws, right, that have been created. And as you were just stating so eloquently, very, very often they have been in service to the ruling class, you know, certainly focused on acquiring, stealing, retaining wealth through oppression most often, and subjugation of peoples all around the world, and especially people of African descent, but certainly our indigenous, you know, the folks here in this country have a great deal to teach and share about treaties and what they have meant and what they have not meant and how they've not been honored. But the simplest level in terms of my involvement and the work with at a national level to help build awareness and encourage a continuing movement toward human rights cities has really been just the understanding that human rights are bigger, and that's just the bottom line. We as human beings, by virtue of the fact that we breathe, no matter what else, you know, can characterize us, we deserve to have, you know, certain things, and those should not be encumbered by other human beings. They should not be encumbered by man-made laws, et cetera. And those include things that bring, for example, the right to water, right? And situations like we know so much about from Flint now, but also many other places. The brother that just spoke about Gary, you know, we know that in East Chicago, just a stone's throw away, very intentional building of elementary school and low-income housing, the projects, on a lead dump. But, you know, so there's things that would not happen in your city, your town, your rural area, if in fact the powers that be and the people really understood and respected humanity. That's the whole, you know, I guess I'm not trying to oversimplify it, and I hope no one feels that I am, but that's really the gist of it, is, you know, clear everything else away. What, as a human being, you are entitled to just by virtue of the fact that you breathe would be something that would be proactively worked toward by every institution, every organization, and every individual. If, in fact, or when, in fact, we all just continue to stand up and march forward and demand that it is going to be human rights that we will apply and not have the same sorts of games that we have, which are resulting in our people dying in the streets, we know, every single day. So, you know, just the fact that people have such problems with, can you imagine homelessness or housing problems? How can that be? We have in so many cities all these vacant homes, right? Just stolen from people through the predatory lending practices of banks that got bailed out by decisions that were made by politicians who were bought off. You know, I chuckle, but it's absolutely not comical at all. But again, we have a right to home. You have a right to housing. You have a right to culture. There are so many things that if we do look at, and people can just Google, right, the UDHR, as again, Dr. Randall mentioned a little while ago, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is, I would say, I won't say a partner document, but it's another set of the higher standard at some level. If you want to know what the human rights are that the Universal Declaration says that you are entitled to, as long as we fight for them, it can happen. And it's right there in a document. So I'm sorry, I don't want to be too long-winded. I know you're hearing from each person on different questions, but I definitely want to come back to that right to culture. And that's one of the things that we as a national steering committee are really taking guidance from people at the local level who are interested in moving forward to hold their local decision makers accountable to human rights standards as opposed to only this constitutional law or the local policies and practices. That's the gist of this. So I hope that we will continue to inspire people to learn more and to move forward together to push for whatever can happen locally to be able to apply the human rights standards, even where there are treaties that have not been ratified, such as the rights of the child, which and the CEDAW, the rights of women, which, you know, as the how do we define ourselves in the U.S., you know, leaders of the free world, to be among the very last and to still be holding out and refusing to ratify treaties that guarantee the rights of the child and the rights of women? How do we do that?
Hypocrisy, yes. Thank you so much, Vicky, for, again, giving us more connective tissue to the conversation of how all this is fitting together. And isn't it quite something that all of us who have been inspired by the late El-Hajj Malik El-Shabazz and Malcolm X, and his forthright stand that he declared. I declare my human rights as a man, as a human, to be respected right here on earth, right now. And to hear that, that was impetus in terms of the radio station coming into being, and all of us are, in fact, walking along that same path in terms of our study, in terms of our research, in terms of our work. Certainly I, too, am a student of Malcolm, and was always curious of why he demanded that it was a human rights struggle. It's not a civil rights struggle. And then I'm also reminded, I must say, in this conversation, the late ancestor, Imari Obadeli, the founder of the Republic of New Africa.
Ashe.
He asked this question. He said, when did we consent? When did we consent to be kidnapped? When did we consent to be transported? When did we consent to be terrorized? When did we consent to be forced into slavery? He said, when did we consent? We never consented. And as a result of that, we are living with the violation of international law in terms of our kidnap, in terms of our transport, in terms of our enslavement. So Durbin, and it's I don't know if it's come up, but yes, it has come up a few times. Durbin, South Africa, when the world met and declared that slavery was a crime against humanity and that it has always been that, and it should have been declared that, was a major breakthrough on so many levels, and we still aren't really fully educated and informed about that. And if you can compare our people being in slavery in Texas, Galveston, 2.5 years later after the Proclamation of Emancipation, and hearing about it, and then having the celebration Juneteenth now, which we are enjoying, you know, that's 2.5 years. Well, it's been, 15 years since Durban, and people still don't know about it. So the clock is going backwards on us in some kind of way, which emphasizes how important these individuals are and the work that they do to educate the people so we can organize. Educate, agitate, organize, as we used to say in the East, and we just had our Kwanzaa reunion last Saturday. And for those who are listening, I would say make prayers for Mama Amanisha, who was the wife of Jitu, who had a stroke that Friday evening. So keep her in your prayers. So it is about the question, when did we consent? We never did consent. So to the degree that our people will understand human rights and use that as an organizing tool, will be to the extent in which we can see our freedom soon come. So Brother Santabantu also is the co-founder and on the National Steering Committee of Human Rights City. So Brother, please talk about your involvement with Human Rights Cities. Why do you think it's important? What kind of progress have you noticed or not to date? And certainly mention Pennsylvania.
Oh, D.C., right? The D.C.
Washington, D.C. The one before D.C., which is in Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh was 2015. And then D.C. is 2016. And then Vicky and I were up in Boston this past, early this month in December. So please give us a little chronology of those three incidents, if you will, and your involvement.
Well, let me say, Brother Onaji, in the spirit of Amilcar Cabral, I don't want to tell any lies, and I don't want to claim any easy victories. At this point in Denver, Colorado.
Brother, let me tell you something, man. You know I have that thing sitting right next to me on my nightstand. Return to Source, Amilcar Cabral.
Well, in that spirit, let me first of all say that while I am immensely concerned about continuing with all of you to really build the momentum for Human Rights City. Certainly here we in Denver, we need a Human Rights City. At this point in Denver, Colorado, we do not yet have an adequate momentum, I would say, to really do more than begin to try to broaden the education and the organizing around the just demand, the legitimate demands for human rights. So let me say that it's not that the work is not important, it's that the work is it's taking us some time to develop our capacity here. And I think that in some ways, you know, we've perhaps lost some opportunities, but we also know that we have some opportunities that are existing at this point. We're struggling very hard to try to begin to move in the direction of making a shift. I think one of the things that's very important about this current moment is that we have a lot of emphasis in a lot of places on militant activism, putting together militant actions that draw people and also get some degree of coverage from the press. But those mobilizations, as I know, I have no doubt that all of you will agree, those mobilizations will not be as significant as they should be unless we are doing the day-to-day, behind-the-scenes, nitty-gritty, difficult work outside the limelight of organizing. And we are now trying to make a shift. We're trying to develop local leadership and make that shift so that we are actually doing the organizing that then renders those actions as we have them much more significant. So that's the truth of that matter. We are in the process of developing the momentum to work on building Denver, Colorado as a human rights city. But I want to say, you know, you asked a question some time ago, perhaps not for this particular show, but I believe the first show that we were supposed to try to have, and there was some kind of technological problems, I believe. You asked a question as to whether or not human rights campaigns or the human rights city movement that's building could benefit our people. And I would say, you know, a resounding yes, and I think all of us would say that. I want to take a bit of a cue, if I might, from Professor Randall and Sister Vicky. I want to sort of take up the stance of the Sankofa bird. We need to look backwards in order to properly look forward. And when we look at the United States, and we look at the post-World War II context, now, it's a long time ago. I know I'm dating myself, but we got to do this, I think, in order to really get a larger sense of what Sister Vicky and Professor Randall have been saying, and what you also, Brother Onaji, have been saying about the hypocrisy that is literally institutionalized in this country. When we look at the post-World War II context, coming out of the struggle against fascism with the Nazis and with Mussolini and with Japan, what we see is that there was the establishment of a human rights system. But what we must grapple with, and it is still one of the reasons, I think, why so many people look at us funny when we go to them and try to talk about human rights, at least in our initial conversation with them. They see it as very abstract. Well, they see it as situated within the UN, the United Nations. Well, one of the reasons they have that kind of reaction is because when the human rights system was constructed, the people who came together and called for a human rights system still were supporting colonization of our people. They were still not putting at the center of the conversation of the experiences of peoples of color, heterosexual women, or women who were not heterosexual. They were not looking at the broad spectrum of humanity. And so people who were not heterosexual, white and male, tended to fall out of the conversation or to be left out of the conversation. We are still trying to deal with that problem. And that's why when we talk about human rights, I think that there's a couple things we have to do as we go forward trying to build these human rights movements toward human rights cities. We need to remember, particularly amongst African American people, those instances where black folk, folk that look just like us, and many of the people who are listening to us, actually called for our human rights. You mentioned El Haj Malik El Shabazz. We also could talk about Dr. Du Bois calling for human rights and decolonization in the post-World War II period.
Yeah.
We could also talk, we could talk about Brother William Patterson and those who mounted the demands that led to the We Charge Genocide Declaration. We could talk just about the Sojourners for Truth and Freedom, black women who were feminists who were talking to the U.S. State Department and called on them to end the genocidal attacks during the 30s and the 40s upon African Americans and all Afro-descendant people. So El Haj Malik El Shabazz was not the first time. We have a legacy. We have shoulders on which we stand, and I think that's one of the things that we have to help our people to see. Now, I will say just one other thing, and that is that one of the things that we find today, when we try to take human rights to people in our communities, they think that we're coming with, maybe a UN petition. In some cases, UN petitions are fine. I mean, when I worked with one of the reasons why Sister Vicky Professor Randall and Brother Stan Willis and I met, I believe it was in Geneva. I think I met you in Geneva also, Vicky, but that really is perhaps neither here nor there. I know Stan was there. But one of the reasons we ended up going there is because we wanted to take documents that are called shadow reports to the committee sitting in Geneva to talk about, that was going to examine the compliance and non-compliance in 2008 of the United States with respect to its leadership in CERD, the Convention on All Forms of Racial Discrimination. One of the things that became clear is that the process that the UN has set up, whereby you can go and present testimony, both written and oral, before this international committee of racial experts, that is important. That's important work. And so we put together a shadow report, because whenever the U.S. government has to have its examination of its record, the State Department always puts forth its own report card, its own report. Well, the United States government is going to give itself an A- or a B+. Well, we came in 2008 with about 300 pages of documents that said basically we need to give a D- or an F+, because when we look at the lived experiences of people on the ground are having human rights violated every day. And so there's a difference between talking about using the instruments of human rights and as you said when you opened us up, Brother Onaji, we have to declare that we are human beings. We have to embody that declaration in what we do individually and collectively in terms of our politics, and so that's how I think we begin to move, to not only have this conversation about human rights cities, but to do that in the context of a period where we're having to consider why our lives don't matter more as black people, and what are we going to do now as we're about to see the most venomous expressions of the Trump power. I'll stop right there.
Well, brother, your time is impeccable. We have to take a station break, and we're going to return to this conversation. But I must say that the listening audience, you must begin to appreciate the wisdom, the history, the work that the panelists have given to us, to our people, to our struggle. And such a great gift it's been, and you can just hear glimpses of it just in terms of their ability to give us so much information in such a little bit of time. So we're going to take a station break, but we want you to call up your friends and have them tune in as well to hear the second part of the show. So Scotty, take it away. Yeah.
Okay.
Black Talk Radio, since 2008, providing new black media for the masses.
Good evening, everyone. I think I'm back on the air with the mic. This is Onaji Moweed, the co-host of Race Treaty, a radio show that stands on our human rights, in particular looking at CERD, its implementation, and using the radio show as a format, forum for a gathering human rights activists for our human rights, for our dignity, for our life, for our progeny. And we've had on this past hour our guests give us their name, their affiliate organization, which was the first round. And then the second round, we asked the question, what is their involvement with this emerging new aspect of human rights, which is called human rights cities, and their involvement with it, and how do they see it being advantageous to our work as human rights activists. But we still have one other person to speak to it, and maybe he can't say his direct involvement, but I do want to ask Brother Lamphile what he heard so far, right? Were there any similarities in terms of his religious organization and the work they do, what they do? Does he see any similarities where there is some type of cohesion? Lamphile?
Yes, good brother. I appreciate that again, the introduction. But Brother Onaji, you have to remember I came from a school in Moore Science that dealt with almost every concept and principle that you all touched on. Even the subjective manner of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, like Article 15, 16, or 18, those are definitely relative points and documents that I'm familiar with. And then you talk about treaties like the Peace and Friendship Treaty of 1786 between the United States and Morocco that directly talked about the transport of individuals that were the subject of Morocco, because at that point in time in history, that whole western portion of Africa was under the dominion of the Emperor of Morocco. So everything that you all have touched on has been a great segue for me, because the greatest human rights activist, peace promoter, designator and embodiment of the principle of love for all humanity, in my perspective, was a man called Sheikh Amadou Bamba, who during his lifetime, the French attempted to kill him 286 times. All of those unsuccessful. They sent him on 2 to 3 exiles, and then for the rest of his life after his exiles, he was on house arrest. This man suffered for what I would call our people, and we have a city, a holy city, some people would call it sovereign city, that isn't under the jurisdiction of any colonial power, because historically we know that Otto von Bismarck organized the Berlin Conference, and that's why we have the map of Africa in red, green, purple, and blue, because of the different colonial powers that colonized. So when you talk about what I can comment on, I'm 100% in. Sheikh Amadou Bamba is 100% on. Racial discrimination, he was not against it. He spoke specifically like, do not ignore my writings because of my dark skin. He even made it to the point where he wanted us to understand as an African people that the spirituality that resided within all religions was a concept, according to the teachings of Sheikh Anta Diop, to back it up, was a concept of something that migrated from the highest aspects of our civilization in points like Egypt, migrated down and this can be traced linguistically as well as through cranial structure down to places like Timbuktu, and then from over to Timbuktu, even go further west over to West Africa, Senegal. But you talk specifically about human rights, the protection of human rights, our struggle, the human rights in the cities. But we have to make sure that we embody the concept and principle of love. We must have a point of focus, and it must be a continual work that we can hand down from generation to generation, because it took several hundreds of years to put us in this condition, and it's going to take a strategic use of social media to bring about a conscious shift in our mindset to establish us as what I would call repatriated Africans. Repatriated Africans not only means a repatriation physically, like taking you back home, but a repatriation of your culture, a repatriation of your history, and a repatriation of your spirituality. I don't want to get into religion, but I want to get into the spirituality, which is the undercurrent, which is the essence of all religion. It is the cake, and religion is the icing. So there's a lot I could say. I think I hit enough points just to let you know that I am really enjoying this. But it was from 1774 to 1779 that these people called Negro, Blacks, and Color, these names were created for these people that was on this boat that had the subjects of the Emperor of Morocco. So from 1774 to 1779 in the city of Philadelphia, there was this thing called Congressional Congress and Continental Congresses, and they had all these meetings, and they established what they were going to do, because in 1786, from 1779 to 1786, they then now have a peace and friendship treaty saying that they won't have any subjects of the Emperor of Morocco on their ships, but all of these so-called Negroes, Blacks, and Coloreds are no longer considered subjects of the Emperor of Morocco. Therefore, their human rights has been violated. And as long as they adhere to those names of Negro, Black, and Colored, because African American is not a nationality, people from Italy are Italian. If they're born in America, they're Italian American. Africa is a continent and not a nation. And I think right there, Brother Najee, I would like to stop, because I don't know what my time limit is.
Well, folks, you have seen, you have witnessed that as the universe has conspired in our favor, he needed to be here, bringing that piece of history, his own life, and his own experience. So, brother, thank you so much for bringing that. I will say that we do at some point need to construct the history of Black NGOs, and for that I'll turn to SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. When my teacher, Irvin Davis, was one of the first NGO representatives. I forget who, James, who also was, can't think of his last name right now. So we have this history that we have to raise up, and it's been raised up a few times in this conversation, but we have to remember the work that our people have done building this bridge that we are still constructing, but we have walked across those planks that they have put in place. And it's so good to call up Noble Drew Ali and his work in terms of saying that we are independent people, and to look at these strategies, and to, of course, talk about Tuba. So if we're talking about a human rights city, well, guess what? We have the example that's already in place, right? So the more we know about Tuba and see how it operates, and see how people are living, how do they feel for each other, what's the quality of their relationships, we'll ask the questions, is there homelessness there? We'll ask the questions, are people starving there? We'll ask the questions, are people out of work? We'll ask those fundamental questions in terms of the quality of life, and then we'll see exactly to what extent is it not only a human rights city, but if it's in fact a spiritual city. So we're going to invite you back, brother, so you can give us more insight on that. I want to now ask again if Robin has returned. If not, we'll go forward. But I wanted to stop here and maybe give you, all of you, a chance to ask each other questions or clarifying questions or comments on some of the things that you've heard from the other panelists, because this last hour was definitely a full, it was rich, it was brimming. So I want to stop and let you have a dialogue amongst yourselves around some of these issues.
Najee, I was...
Oh, go ahead. That's okay.
Please, go ahead.
Excuse me for interrupting. I was disconnected and have been listening to the conversation and didn't get an opportunity to introduce myself. And so I wanted to slate that in yet, Najee, because I'm in my car on the phone and listening intently to this conversation that's been going on. And I have a little input and thoughts on this, so I'll share later. Thank you.
So, Robin, please share now. This is certainly the time, unless you prefer to wait till later.
Well, no, not, I didn't want to interrupt Madam about to introduce her.
You're not interrupting at all. It's Vicki Casanova Willis again from National Conference of Black Lawyers, a very, very quick, as well as the U.S. Human Rights Network and the National Human Rights Cities Steering Committee. I just wanted to put a couple of points out for our conversation before we conclude this call. One is just the recognition again of the right to culture, but also the fact that the International Decade for People of African Descent, we are in the early years of this decade, and having come out of the work that you all did in Durban, it's just really important that we continue to use every opportunity to both inform people but also invite people to help define what this decade will mean. And then separately, I wanted to invite you and encourage you to help plan for the next Human Rights Cities Conference, which is not until 2018, but it will be hosted in Jackson, Mississippi. So I just wanted to put those two things on our radar for the balance of the call at some point. And we'd love to hear from you, Robin. Thank you.
Well, thank you for sharing that information. That's very important. I just want to give a quick background to Race Treaty. It is dedicated to the decade. It comes out of the understanding of CERD, ICERD, and that white supremacy is illegal, thereby the United States civil rights structure is illegal vis-a-vis human rights. However, there's no apparatus for us as a people to bring our issues really with more momentum than we've had in the past. And I heard the conversation about water and how that's become a major national and global issue. But what it reminded me was that Canada had to petition the United Nations on behalf of Detroit, right across the bridge there in Ontario, because there was not a human rights apparatus really established in Detroit to address the government and the water issue there. And that kind of was a catalyst for me in understanding that all of these grassroots movements and from Occupy to Black Lives Matter to whatever movements really are under the umbrella of human rights, and yet they don't they don't mold their issues under that umbrella consciously as much as I feel like we should. I wanted to also share an experience I had with Najee coming out of three different experiences in reference to human rights and human rights cities, and that was at a recent conference for human rights organizers. And that is that the issue of reparations, the issue of human rights cities as a movement was brought up with Najee. And then we had a very important, I think, a presentation by Dr. Dwight Mullins, who has created, he's a sociologist professor, has created a class focused on something called the State of Black Asheville, where they've actually extracted and labeled the various areas from United Compensatory Code or the various areas of people activity, and he got all of the data, extracted all the data at the class project, and what he's created is a human rights report, because it gives the information on housing, education, law enforcement, and it's glaring in that he's been doing it for 10 years, so you can see a historical pattern of, say, depletion of housing, economic down, in all areas, actually. And because of that, it sparked in my mind how to organize from a human rights perspective around each one of those issues based on disparate impact and disproportionality. And so, you know, as we organize, I organize on a grassroots level. So I see the human rights cities as a means to engage the city council to enact ordinances and embrace international law, which is really should be the precedent for policies and our law. So we have the federal human rights network or apparatus, but we need a local organizing, very conscious raising human rights movement as well. So I wanted to bring those issues up and really hand this conversation back over, because I'm really enjoying this this group. Dr. Vanilla Randall, you're one of my heroes. I've opened many doors. And you, one of the statements you made to me is impacting me since is that you were somewhat melancholy on the prospect of our engaging in this decade and pushing for international law and ICERT and CERB. Given the experience out of Durban, were we going to reorganize and reactivate our efforts to bring our issues to the international arena under the umbrella of human rights law? And you've inspired me, and I wanted to let you know that. And I'm going to carry that as far as and as long as I can. And so thank you, Dr. Randall.
Thank you so much, Adam. It's been my pleasure to work with you.
Brother Najee,
Yes, sir, brother. Well, actually, you're so accurate in terms of that recognition. And Queen Mother Randall, we would like you to talk to us about the decade, the principles of recognition of justice and development. How do you see it, you being a long-distance runner, being our elder in this movement, how do you see this opportunity before us? What are our marching orders in terms of what should we be doing at this point?
Well, first of all, I want to thank you for all of the honor you give me. However, I have to tell you that I think you all's minds is as good as mine, and that I am open to hearing from you all about where you think this should go, because one of the things I am, you know, having worked at this so long, it just seems I don't know that I have a good idea. I have an idea of what has been done and has not worked. That's what I can tell you. I don't know what that means for whether you didn't work because of who we were, or didn't work because of the time, or didn't work because something different is needed to be done. But it seems to me that a fresh look at this is what is needed. I do the human rights work because it is all about human rights. But we are in, I think I'm going to tell a story real quick, and the old people love to tell stories, but it struck me about how systems can outweigh individuals. And so that any concession you get from a system is only temporary if it's based on the individual. Mm-hmm. And this occurred, this story, 30 years ago when I started teaching at the University of Dayton, they had a 50% failure rate in black law students. And I said, look, this is just unacceptable. And I know it's not necessary. And so I convinced them, we put together academic support program, and it wasn't running well. And even though I hadn't gotten tenure, I said, look, I'll take over the program because I know that I can do it. My dean even threatened me. He said, you don't have time to take over the program. You should let this other person do it. I said, no, if I don't have time to do it, then I don't have time to help someone else. So they let me take it over, and I turned it around. And I turned it around so much that people stopped saying academic support programs don't help. What they started saying is it's their unfair advantage, because the students who came in was just like outperforming everybody, winning prizes, lower LSAT, lower GPA, and grading high in classes. One year we had a black editor-in-chief and a black assistant editor-in-chief, both from my program. I say this that they didn't like the program, but there wasn't much they could do. And over the years, I got arrogant because I felt, you know, this has been around 26 years and it's successful. And guess what happened when I retired? They stopped the program almost immediately. And things have reverted back. Black students are in trouble again. And so it just seems to me that the one thing that I've learned, both, and this is also the work that we have tried to get, that the system makes no concessions that are going to be permanently useful. The Clinton administration did, the Bush didn't, the Bush administration didn't, and the Obama administration didn't. And then when you get on a local level, even when you work locally, you get concessions. For instance, here in Dayton, we were able, long before the collapse, Dayton passed a law to deal with predatory lending, and the state went and said that we couldn't do it and overturned the law.
Wow.
So I guess what I'm saying is that this work has to be done, but you've got to learn from the lesson that of those of us who've been here, and that in the system, and that is, A, the system doesn't give you anything that really changes it, and B, if you get concession, it's temporary, and that temporary can be like 26 years, 30 years, and then they will revert back to whatever it is that they have. So for our work on this, the reason I am hopeful about the Human Rights Cities movement, and I think this is really it, is that while laws don't mean you're going to get what you should, they're certainly open to interpretation. They do give you a basis for arguing for what you should get if it's in the law. So if you can get your local municipality to adopt some version of the human rights standard in their municipal law, then you have a basis for local activism that is stronger than state or national activism. and I'll stop.
Whoa. We need to know what has been tried, what has been successful, and the tactics used against that success. As we know, as Brother Fatabantu had pointed out, when the United Nations came into being, the world was still in colonial constraints, and many of the people, which we called nations, were subjected to state apparatuses. So from there came the emerging thinking about, well, what do we do with these people? Some people can say are nations, other people are called national minorities. And what's happening now in the world is this revival of the right of self-determination by these captive nations, that which we are a captive nation. So if we're going to use the thinking of Emmanuel Bedelli or the thinking, the strategy of Yusuf Clyde, it has to do with special rights. It has to do with special measures and special rights, and how and when we use strategies to bring those things into existence, and then we find ourselves being maneuvered over time. We need to document this. Van Boven said reparations is compensation, restitution, rehabilitation. Then he added a fourth measure, a monitoring system. And this is what Robin has been talking about for the last, at least as long as I've known him. We need a monitoring system to start to record all the human rights violations that's happening on a day-to-day basis in Dayton, in Chicago, in North Carolina, in Philadelphia, all the places in which we live. We need a monitoring system to accumulate this data. We need the aggregate of all the human rights, and we'll keep dumping it to the United Nations through the working group. This conversation is certainly one to be studied and referenced and continued. So let me say that every good deed deserves another. So this is part one of a part two series. So I'm asking everyone to look at their calendars to see if it's all possible to block out another 2 hours next Friday, if it's all possible, because we're just really skimming the surface. I mean, we're doing a good job at it, but certainly there are a lot of intricacies that we won't have time to get into given the constraint of time. So it's now 10:28, so we have a half hour left. And Elder, you know, thank you, Queen Mother. Randall, thank you so much for staying, because I know that you had said in the beginning you didn't know how long you could stay, and you have stayed as long as you have. I want to recognize that. And I want to ask you, is there anything else in the conversation that you observed or didn't have a chance to speak on? I just want to give you that time now, just in case you choose to use that your exit veto to leave the conversation before we conclude. So I just want to give you at least another 5 minutes to say whatever's on your mind and your heart, because certainly we could use that, because we don't want to make the same mistakes. You've already shown us what they can do if you do this. So I just want to give you some more time to speak to us on these issues.
Thank you so much for recognizing me. And I really, you know, if someone has a specific question that they have of me, I will be happy, but I really want to listen to the rest of you all.
Okay. Any questions for Queen Mother Randall at this point?
Let me just ask a brief question, if I may. Professor Randall, this is Tonda Bantu from Denver. I'm just wondering how much success you were able to have in getting folk
on the, you know, in the communities or in the churches or some of the regular institutions that we have in Black communities, to what extent were you able to sort of connect them up as supporters of your program? I'm just wondering if having layers of support and circles of support might help to make it more difficult for the administrators of some of these institutions to, even after 30 years or so, to just cut a program if, in fact, that program is being supported widely by, you know, everyday folks in the institutions of the community.
That's an excellent question. And the fact of the matter is I think many in the community, like the lawyer base in our community, are as far as people who went through the program within the community himself, and organizations are people who supported the program. But one of the problems, and you probably, any community that is under attack feels this, is people are spread physically, emotionally, and socially and economically thin.
Yes.
It's so much. We live Dayton. I live in a food desert. 50% of our houses are unoccupied in my community. Trying to get people to fight a battle, a very specific battle, when they're fighting all kinds of battles, it becomes very hard. Even the professionals, it seems to me, I think that's one of the things that we have to figure out a better way. The model of organizing in which we go to the community for support becomes ineffective, I think, when the community is stretched too thin, very thin. And I don't know what an alternative is. Is that making sense?
Thank you so much. That's very
absolutely
instructive.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Very instructive. Thank you.
Queen Mother Randall, we need you desperately to guide us. You know, you say that you want to hear these new ideas, but we need to hear, you know, not now, right this moment, but we need a session that, you know, be off the cameras, you know, or behind the wall, to really look at that. So as we go to construct this Human Rights Cities movement, we know where the bombs are. We'll know where the planted mines are.
I would be happy to do that, but I've been thinking a long time that we have a 19th century idea, a Jim Crow idea about organizing the community to work on issues of neo-slavery. And when the community was all in the same boat and being attacked in all in the same way, I'm not ever sure we ever had 100% at any time. In fact, I doubt we had more than 20 or 30% of the community who was active. But now we have the community who is dispersed and who's being attacked even within their homes. Television, media. These are all attacks. When I turn on I'm a TV watcher and I love TV, but I've come to realize that it's a major stressor. If you the racism that is embedded in there. And if you're not thinking, so you come home working thinking that you're going to de-stress. But you open up and, you know, the music is a stressor. The books are a stressor. Dealing with your children, you know, I went to a segregated school and I realized that one of the things that I didn't have to deal with was the racism of my teachers. And my son had to deal with that, and I realized that my parents didn't have to deal with that either. So that meant that these young parents who are stressed to death because they're working in these historically white institutions and being bombarded day in and day out, and it doesn't matter what level they're working and what kind of work they're doing, they come home and they got a child who is going through something at school. And I believe that one of the things that's happening is parents feel protective. We all do. And parents who may, first reaction is, I may not be able to protect myself, but I'll protect my child. So they get angry and they act out towards the school, trying to protect their child from racism. We have 40% of blacks who have an implicit anti-black bias. Think about that. So when we start thinking about solutions, you know, it's not, I don't know. I just think it's very complicated to think about how we're going to pull the community in.
Yeah, I have to agree with you. Yeah, I'm so glad to hear you articulating this. I shouldn't say glad, because it's very it is disheartening. But we do have to be, you know, again, in the spirit of Nia, we have to be purposeful, right? I am just, and I'm sorry, I don't want to interrupt you. But I was hearing the percentage that you were sharing of, you know, 40% with this implicit or embedded, inherent self-hatred, if you will. And where I live, it's just much, 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 much higher. And it is very much, I say that because I live in Chicago, and just a little over 24 hours ago, one of my students just 15 was murdered in the street. It was not by the police this time. It was by some other children. And, you know, they were literally coming from a dance performance. They had just performed, so they weren't out gang-banging or whatever. But there's just that these are students living in a community where over 100 schools were closed within a period of, you know, less than 2 years. Just the whole nine yards. You talk about the media, and you're absolutely right. It's more than a stressor when we hear what is happening on the airwaves for stations, Clear Channel stations, for example. It's part of testimony that we gave to the United Nations visiting group, the working group of experts on people of African descent, when they were here in January. To help them really understand the direct attack on the minds and the psyches of our children in particular, and contrasting that statistically, some of the work that folks, in fact, Brother Kwabena Musuli out of Gary has been doing great work, and they literally have researched and run the statistics to see that the comparison for radio stations targeting Caucasian youth versus black youth is, you know, 25-1 in terms of the lyrics that are misogynistic, violent, you know, elevating and glorifying drugs, and whole nine yards. This is very, very systemic, but it's also very strategic and intentional. So you're so right, and I'm so it just makes me rededicate myself to the work that we know we have to do, but also it helps me understand an even bigger part of the dilemma when we're working to first educate our community and especially our young people who have to carry this forward, you know, and they're literally dodging bullets, can't even walk home from school without risking being gunned down in the street. For me to talk to them about human rights, right, is just, it's not necessarily something when you speak about parents wanting to keep their kids safe, you know. And yet, we do know that there is significant merit from a very practical, tangible standpoint. Again, Chicago, in terms of bringing human rights home, this is literally what changed the game finally after decades of torturing of black boys and men by the police. It was finally taking the case to the UN, to the international arena through CERT and CAT that got the attention internationally, which finally put pressure on people, you know, in our government, and then it came all the way down to begin to bring about some change. So this is such huge, these are huge shoulders and to stand on, not huge shoulders, but do you know what I mean? I appreciate the work Dr. Randall and so many have done for such a long time, and we just are looking to do our part.
Ashe.
So, Amoco Cabral's name came up in the conversation tonight, and I think we've made a turn to Algeria, to Martinique, and certainly France Fanon, that the colonized takes on the mind of the colonizer in their values, in their lifestyle, in their pursuits, and the violence that we are now experiencing inside of our communities. The lateral violence that we are giving to each other is, in fact, a consequence of oppression, of internalized inferiority. And I don't say self-hatred. I say induce self-hatred. So if you say self-hatred, it gives the idea that we've created this idea. We created it. Started with us. It comes
yeah,
from
I agree with you. Mm-hmm.
The outside.
I agree with you.
And so when we... So when we speak of these, this reality, we have to say induce self-hatred because it comes from someplace else. So therefore, we are realizing that our work is both resolving the aggression from the outside coming in and also resolving the aggression from the inside, staying inside, right? We implode rather than explode. So I work with Cure Violence. And it started in Chicago, but now it's reached a number of other cities, New York City being one of them. My wife and I, in fact, we both work with Mary Pendergreen, and we're working with those brothers and sisters on the street who want to turn their lives around, have turned their lives around, and now want to make a contribution to the community. So they go out as violence interrupters, or they may be outreach workers. So I don't think there's ever been a time when we've had the involvement of, if you will, that element. I mean, we could talk about the Nation of Islam, but of course they became separatists, and if he wasn't part of them, he wasn't part of what they were doing. But now there is another element of those who have created the havoc and the shootings, where they are participating in our resolve. So we do need to think thoroughly about the ways in which we are engaging our people and what segments. So we have another, if you will, another column that we hadn't had before. Not in this way. These are people who are connected to those who are still in the street, where they can go and talk to them and be and inoculate them from the other things which are taking place. So there are new elements in on the stage of our movement that has to be brought into being and having seats at the table. So we're not going to go into, as Vicky said and what I said earlier, we were going to talk about
the United Nations decade for African people from 2015 to 2024. We're not going to go into it now, but we know we've set the stage for it. I had already said that we're going to have a part two, and hopefully everyone on this call can also participate in part two. So I would like to kind of go around again with any concluding observations or comments that you would like to share, certainly with each other and with the listening audience. And again, I'm going to start with Queen Mother Randall.
Thank you. I feel like that there is that we dais, descendants of Africans enslaved in the United States, and I think that there's a real need for us to carve that term out, that we are a survival people, and that we will find a way, and we will use the mechanisms that are in front of us, and we will make new mechanisms. And I do think that this is about human rights, not civil rights, and that there is a foundation that has been laid, whether or not our country wants to use it, that we can use it in a way to call attention here, and hopefully at some point be able to legally use them to make changes. And that's what gives me hope with the Human Rights City movement. And thank you so much for inviting me and for all of you all's comment, and I look forward to other conversations. Thank you.
Thank you. Vicki, do you want to?
Hi, yes. Again, I just encourage everyone, wherever they are, to really inform themselves about the human rights framework and what it really means in terms of stepping outside of the constraints that constitutional, you know, laws may define for us, and understand what international law, which also applies here, says we are entitled to from a proactive standpoint. And then, as you know, each one teach one. I mean, right, we before we can really effectively do what Brother Robin was saying, which I love, the idea of a course, and you know, we homeschool. It doesn't have to be in a formal institution. We could literally work in small groups to do report cards for, you know, what would our school look like if it were a human rights school? What would our block look like if we were a human rights block? You know, we are creative people, and just in the spirit, again, of NEA purpose, which says that the goal is to make our collective vocation the building and developing of our community in order to restore our people to their traditional greatness. The human rights framework and the human rights cities movement here in the U.S. is a powerful tool to do that. I look forward to working with you all.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
For picking you. Dr. Bantu.
Yes, I just want to say that I have been enlightened and uplifted participating with you all, and I look forward to continuing this process. I'm going to try to make sure that next Friday, I might tell my grandkids we can't go to the movies Friday. I got to do this on Friday. We go on Saturday. But I would like to just say one last thing about this document that we've been talking about. I think we have set the stage for talking about how we can go forward as Vicki and Sister Vicki and Professor Randall and others have said, using this international convention on the elimination of all forms of racial discrimination. You know, we talk about this document, and very often we lose sight of the fact that this document actually speaks to much more than just racial discrimination. This document, which I hope folks will take a look at
if they have time, it's the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination, CERD, capital C, capital E, capital R, capital D, or ICERD, capital I-C-E-R-D. You can look that up, and maybe as we look toward the next conversation in cyberspace, perhaps folks will have had an opportunity to take a look at it. Maybe we can post it in its entirety on Black Talk Radio. I don't know. There's a number of ways that we can do this, but I do just want to flag one thing about this document, and that is that in 2000, when the International Committee had received the reports of people who were talking about the conditions on the ground, it had to acknowledge the significant work done by Black women and other women of color to make it clear that a lot of times what we understand as racial discrimination is both racial and gender discrimination. Now, this is a lot to try to take on, so I'm not trying to open up something that we can't deal with this evening. I just want to put it on the docket so that at some point in the near future, we can begin to go back to this international document to actually look at how people have used it. I'm talking about feminists and, you know, women of color, you know, and Black women in the United States have used this document to actually open up the conversation on what the lived experiences of Black men and Black women, Black females and males, has actually been. This is a very, we are caught up, this oppression that we're caught up in is extremely dispiriting at times. It's also very complex, but as I think Vicky just said it, and as, you know, Professor Randall was talking about, we are creative people. We are people who know how to survive.
Close the door.
We know how to survive, and part of our survival is better understanding our experiences of oppression. And this document has actually been used by people across this country to begin to delve more deeply into what our conditions of oppression actually are and actually have been. So I look forward to working with all of you as we go forward. This has been a very good part one. And thank you.
Excellent. Brother Lamphile.
Yes, Brother Najee.
Any concluding comments or observations?
Whew, y'all said a lot, man. For a newbie like me, this is kind of... Y'all make me talk fast, so that's not good. let me try to get it. I got probably 3 minutes. The example that I started out with, the man that I mentioned, Sheikh Amadou Bamba, his grandson still comes to this country once a year and establishes what they call a Sheikh Amadou Bamba Day. It was established by his son, but it was actually his grandson that comes to this day. But every year, the Morids, those are the followers of Sheikh Amadou Bamba's teaching, which is teachings, he said, my religion is the love of God. So these are not delineating teachings on what color you are or race you are. But they have a meeting at the United Nations every year. And out of all the things I've heard, I do know that Sheikh Amadou Bamba was a survivor of 286 attempts on his life. If we ourselves were to just look and calculate, I know myself, I probably had so many attempts on my life, but just imagine if we can use the leverage that we have with Sheikh Amadou Bamba to continue this work that Queen Mother Randall mentioned, just as a model. Because what the youth actually are looking for is the basics, and they get all the basics through money. They need food, clothing, and shelter. They want to feel safe. They're trying to get that money. So if we can find some way that we can transform this social manufacturing, I think it was called, to fulfill our educational, our employment, our manufacturing, our social needs, we fulfill the obligation of being a human and contributing. The next part is just to be recognized as a human using the documentation that the United Nations has designed to be used by those that are human and are connected to the families of nations. So a Negro ain't going to get it by himself. We're going to have to be a collective group of people that establish what we would like to be called, create our own books and education, and no longer be told what to do, no longer be told what we are, who we are, but actually stand up as a human and use what's used for other humans. I can say that based on just following the teachings of Sheikh Amadou Lubumba, who was not scared to be a black man, and who said, you know, don't look down on me just because I'm black. With that, I'd like to say thank you for being a newbie on your show. This is all of our struggle.
It is. International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, Article 27, in fact, speaks to that very issue, that rights, minority rights, religious, ethnic, racial minorities have a right to their language, to their culture, to their education, and the right of assembly. So you're right on it. All these things are certainly showing how they are interconnected, because human rights are indivisible and interrelated. So, Brother Robin, you have the last 3 minutes, beloved, reflections.
Well, I revert back to the title of our show, Race Treaty, another word for CERD or ICERD. And I wanted to share what impacts me about this law, and that is the disparate impact language and disproportionality. And for me, those are two very profound statements or words that we really haven't delved deeper into, because disparate impact means there's a victim. That means victims have rights. And disproportionality means that there's data that shows vice versa or the information, and it makes it clear. And we don't have that information as a requirement, as a standard, as by federal law in the United States. So in a way, I see that the lack of aggregating data is in a way non-compliance to a treaty that the U.S. has signed and ratified and yet doesn't go any further with because of white supremacy. And so I want to reiterate on the CERD is that disparate impact speaks to the victim, our people. By law, we have redress. Disproportionality speaks to what I've experienced on a local level with the state of Black Asheville, that you can aggregate data in all the areas of our experience, and you can see the picture of our status as a city vis-a-vis human rights and human rights law based on this disproportionality and this data. So I'm really inspired to wed those two, and I'm inspired by CERB because it makes me really strengthens my soul and my spirit and my resolve to know that white supremacy is not only a moral or ethical issue, it's not metaphysical, it's illegal. And so we have to burrow into the apparatus to bring this to heel, if to use a late politician's words. But I wanted to speak to that and leave with that. That is a deep, deep, universal right that we have against white supremacy. And I want to stand strong on those grounds. Thank you.
Robin, thank you so much. So we can see from our conversation tonight, Human Rights Cities Movement, if you will, is at the ground level, and the decade is at the top, and how we sandwich all those levels together. But you have to have the bottom and the top for it to be whole. And we have the people. We still need the land, but some of our brothers in Africa got the land, but we'll get to that. So everyone, I want to say thank you for your participation, your listening.
Thank you.
Your brother, your sister, your cousin, your friend. Tell people in your block, tell people in your mosque, in your temple, in your church, in your organizations. Tell them about the station so we can be at the same place, same time, next Friday at 9 o'clock. Thank you, everybody, and have a wonderful evening. Happy Kwanzaa.